Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. On the program this time, we'll talk about the Army Training Information System. As of right now, there is no single system that gives the organization a single big-picture view of all of its training programs and no way to plan them holistically. Instead, it's a mishmash of one-off solutions that are mostly centered around the needs of individual Army bases, and which generally don't communicate with each other. That's what ATIS is intended to fix. Its planners envision a single, standards-based system that handles everything from scheduling space and facilities and ranges to managing the actual content delivered to soldiers. It's a partnership between the Army Training and Doctrine Command and the Program Executive Officer for Enterprise Information Systems. The program's only about a year old, and while there's no official cost estimate yet, for planning purposes, the Army's using a ballpark figure of about $450 million. Our guest this hour to talk about ATIS is the project lead, Joel Phillips. He sat down with me at the Army PEOEIS headquarters at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. Let's talk briefly about the entire genesis of ATIS, and as you said off the air while you're doing it. Give me a little background on that, if you could, sir.
Sure. One of the things that we're focusing on now is that we realize that in this environment, obviously, our diminishing resources, diminishing budgets, the Army's got to improve the way it acquires training support. The way it manages and the way it uses IT is key to that. And what we found that is to support and better execute our training and education programs, we really needed a holistic new start. The Army needs to find a balance between the financial constraints that we're facing and maintain effectiveness in providing the resources required for a trained and ready force. So currently where we're at, so in the Army training environment, what we've got is disparate information systems. they exist at different post camps and stations to collect very specific data, most likely centric to that post or that base or that camp. Many of these systems lack any common operating environment. They don't share data, and they rely on point-to-point interfaces. And what's worse is they collect and store stovepipe non-authoritative data. So what we've ended up with over the accumulation of many years and many people's good intentions is a collection of stovepiped, disparate, redundant systems that don't provide any type of common operational picture.
For people who don't really have any baseline understanding of what the Army training environment is, can you give us a sense of sort of, you know, what are these stovepipes collectively? What sorts of training is delivered through these post-camp station-centric systems?
Sure. Let's talk about the five main areas that we're focusing on in training and as they apply to this level of the program. We're talking about scheduling training. So what happens is in the scheduling arena, you'll have the need to schedule classrooms, the need to schedule ranges, the need to schedule instructors, the need to schedule the abundance of resources that make up a training class. However, there is no system to do that outside of what you develop independently. Then there's development. So think about, you've got all the different centers, the centers of excellence, whether it be the infantry school at Fort Benning, the armor school, the intelligence school at Fort Huachuca, that are developing their own unique programs of instructions for their capabilities. And again, it's resident only at those locations. The next area is content, so learning content management and how that's developed for broader programs, broader training and education areas that will stretch across many environments and many types of specialties in what we need to do as an Army, but yet they're developed at different locations, so the same program of instruction at one place won't be the same at the next. And then everything is more detail on the resources needed. So as you develop your training plan, you realize that you need resources for transportation, you need resources such as ammunition, you need resources to conduct the training, whether it be training aids such as simulators and devices or other types of materials, such as you're going to do, say, a chemical weapons training facility, things like that. So you've got to schedule that, and there's no common environment to do that right now.
The environment that you've described with all these stovepipes does not sound like the most cost-efficient way to run things, for one thing. Has the Army done any kind of detailed look at potential cost savings just from migrating all of this to an enterprise capability?
Yeah, it's funny. That was one of the first things that we had to field as we got started in this program about a year ago. And of course, as you look at the defense business system, that cost analysis or return on investment phase isn't supposed to come till much later on in the program, but as in most things that we do these days, it's the first question that people ask. So let me give you a kind of idea of where we're going with that.
Sure.
So what we had to do initially then is identify all those systems out there that are currently providing a portion or a capability that fits into those five general categories that I mentioned earlier. And then we had to lay out a very tentative plan to say that we know as we develop the enterprise solutions to meet these capabilities, the existing systems need to be retired. And so what we did was we laid out, first we identified the cost of these existing systems, laid out a very conservative plan forward on, look, we know we have to attain IOC or initial operating capability in 5 years. It's a requirement in the DOD. So just given that restraint and that constraint, you can start looking at if that's our IOC date 5 years from now, and then we know because this is a software-intensive system, or it will be a software-intensive system, you're going to look at incremental development after that. What happens as we develop these increments and deliver them is that the existing systems have to be retired. So right away we found, well, here's the cost of, and we have a ballpark number right now. There's about 39 systems out there that are doing a portion of this training capabilities that we're talking about. And they're grouped into these five categories, whether it's scheduling, management, delivery, content, et cetera. And then, okay, so if these get grouped in and then these capabilities are delivered over an incremental development plan, well, right away you can see here's your savings or your cost avoidance based on a big picture initial look.
And do you have a good number that you can talk about publicly right now for what your estimates are?
No, we don't. Right now we're still in the phases of refining that. That information will be ready at our next milestone, which is milestone A.
Okay, so let's pivot a little bit to what ATIS is actually going to be. You've talked about it in some broad terms. Are we talking about a single system that all resides within one single IT architecture? Is it going to be a family of systems? Describe what you kind of view as the end state here, a little bit more detail.
Okay, so let's talk in a big picture first for the end state. Really what we're focusing on is providing the Army. And when I say the Army, I'm talking the active duty, the reserves, the National Guard, and the civilians, the entire Army, five core enterprise capabilities for training. And these consist of scheduling training, developing training, the content of the training, management, and then the resources required to conduct training. So we talked about who, and that's active duty, reserves, guard, and civilians, but what? So what's the next question? So the what is online training, classroom institutional training, training for forward deployed forces, training for home station forces prior to deployment, recurring training, and it's really it comes down to capturing all elements of training with really two exceptions, and that's the Army War College and West Point.
And we hear a lot lately, I think, from all the military services about the increasing importance of live virtual constructive training, partially for budget reasons. With that demand signal coming your way, do you see an increasing need for the types of capabilities that you're building, maybe then even more than what the current stovepipe capabilities are providing right now?
Without a doubt. And not only that, are we focusing on developing the delivery of training, individual or team level training through online environment, we're also including the delivering training and conducting training through devices such as iPhones or other personal owned devices, things that people can do the training right there in whatever environment that they're at. So that is a big focus, and it's something that we are considering as we develop the requirements for the program.
Big topic in those mobile devices right now is identity management, and that takes us into another one of the benefits that I think you're getting at here in bringing this into an enterprise capability, because none of these disparate systems have a common framework for managing identity, right? You want to talk a little bit about that aspect of it?
Yeah, without a doubt, that is a big picture problem for the Army, as it is for many people. So by building the training system at the enterprise level and having one standard identity management, which for us our minimum is going to be the common access card identity verification process. Right now, that's what we're working at. We've talked to a few people that are doing it. We talked to the Joint Knowledge Online program down in Suffolk, Virginia. It's a joint program ran by the J7 staff. They're doing a similar effort at the joint level. So there's a lot of lessons learned out there on identity management. And then it goes into even the next step is what happens when you consolidate all this information at so many different levels. For this broad a group of people, like I talked about, that's about 1.6 million users. When you add in the Guard, the active, the reserves, the civilians, what happens to the data, and what classification of the data do we need to look at? Because you've just brought all these sources of data together. So we're really concerned with that as well. So it's something that we're looking into during our market research and during this phase of analysis of alternatives.
Yeah, that's an important point that I hadn't even thought of. But yeah, I would have to assume that a lot of the information, a lot of the content that's being provided right now is not just strictly unclassified stuff, right?
We do recognize the fact that based on certain training and certain environments, obviously the primary is the intelligence fields and security fields, where you're going to have specifically classified, collateral, secret and above training. But the majority of what we're doing will ride on an FOUO, unclassified network. However, we still recognize the fact that securing that with all of the level of personal identifiable information and the conglomeration of data is going to be a security challenge for us.
That's Joel Phillips, the program manager for the Army Training Information System, or ATIS. We'll come back and talk more after a quick break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servia. Welcome back to On DoD on federalnewsradio.com at 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servia. Talking this hour about the Army Training Information System. The project is still in its infancy as big DoD system developments go, only about a year into the planning process so far. The objective is to replace a huge scattered set of stovepiped training systems across the Army with a single standards-based platform that lets Army leaders plan and manage training from an enterprise point of view. Program officials held their first major industry day and released their first request for information on ATIS earlier this month. Our guest is Joel Phillips. He's the project lead for ATIS within the Army Program Executive Office for Enterprise Information Systems.
Let's talk a little bit more about the status of the program. I know you had an industry day down here to talk to vendors about this, I want to say last week. Mm-hmm. From what you can tell, what's the level of interest out there in the contractor community to support this effort, and where are we in terms of the overall program's development?
All right, so let me talk quickly about the industry day that we conducted last week. So mm-hmm. this was a great program for us, and it started off because of the way we developed it. It wasn't a PEO EIS event singularly. It was a teamed event between the Program Executive Office, Enterprise Information Systems, and our partners in this, which is the Training and Doctrine Command, and more specifically, the training capability manager for Army Training and Information Systems. So it was really a teamed event, and that really was key in bringing in the right experts and the leads across the PEO and TRADOC for this discussion. Here's how we framed it. When the announcement went out, what I told industry was, this was our chance as the government to come to them and educate them as if they've never seen this program, which in a lot of cases, many people have not heard of it because it's been very government-centric and focused over the last year, and really educate them on where it is that we believe we are right now in the process, what capabilities we believe we're going to need to develop to reach the enterprise level of capability that we need, and most importantly, what issues or challenges are we focused on that we'd really like their help in to help leverage some of the work that they've done and the expertise that the industry base has. So we started it off and we went through, described the program, and then we hit the meat of it and we went into, here's where we're stuck. Here's what our issues are. And that opened up really into some intense question and answer period, set up in a panel arrangement where we gave industry the chance all through the day to provide those questions and in real time get answers.
So let's elaborate on that point. Where are you stuck? What can you tell us about that beyond what you've said already?
Sure. What we focused on was describing to industry what we believe our top 10 or 12 challenges are at this phase in the process. And these centered around one of the big things is we're building a new architectural model to operate this system. We're looking at how we're going to operate this system in the cloud, using the combined data center, using cloud technology, and even more of a challenge for us is executing this program through what's called a software as a service model. In other words, we put out the requirements along with, let's call it, service level agreements that we need delivered, and then industry goes out, develops that software, and what we're paying for is the service. We didn't pay for the development. We were not paying for the hosting. We're not paying to buy hardware and data centers. We're paying for the service, and they provide the solution. So it's a big change. It's a big shift from traditionally how the government develops a system either internally with the prime developer or the government hires an integrator type, a systems integrator environment that the government hires to bring together a system. So this new concept is very new to us. The other thing we asked for input on was mobile computing to make sure that we can try to understand, we got to understand what the user's needs are and how the users want to see information in a mobile environment. Because so often you can see by picking up your mobile device, a lot of times you don't think you have the capability to do any constructive training on that small device. So what are the restraints? What are the constraints? What are some of the limitations on mobile computing? We also are interested in looking at what industry sees as performance standards and scalability. In other words, we're talking a big user base for this, but we're also talking it's going to have to be scalable throughout the development process. It's not a Big Bang theory. It's going to be an incremental development. And how would they recommend we manage that process? Security, as we kind of talked about earlier, is a big issue for us, whether it's the combined higher classification of data or operating some of the other classified systems and providing access to those systems. And then a big thing, as I mentioned earlier, we foresee that right now there's at least 39 systems that the Army has operating at different post camps and stations that are providing portions of the training capability. Well, migrating those systems, if that's one of the alternatives that we choose to explore, is going to be an intense problem for us, and we wanted to see what's industry's take on how they would migrate, standardize, and then include such disparate systems and make sure we didn't lose the data and continuity, and the users can't go without service.
Sure.
So how would that happen? Those are kind of our top areas.
Yeah, those are all big ones. Let me circle back to the first one, the software as a service model, which is really interesting. So that being the case, at the end of this process, does the government actually own anything, or is it entirely vendor-owned and operated, and you are literally just consuming a service and paying for it?
Exactly. Think of it in terms of commercial off-the-shelf. It's owned by the vendor, the industry partner who develops it. The government is just paying for the services. So you right away can see advantages and disadvantages of that. You're paying for delivery. You're not paying for development costs, whether it goes well or goes poorly. And keeping in mind, we know it's going to change. So as things change and new standards come out, we're not paying for those upgrades either.
Without a government ownership stake in the system, do you retain the kind of flexibility that you need to make those changes over time? Because you're going to have to put some pretty specific specifications on this, even though you don't technically own the system, right?
Right. I think it's about developing your service level agreements and understanding that those are going to change. It's going to be about banding and grouping those service level agreements for the different capabilities that we need, and then understanding that things are going to change and you're going to need a contracting strategy and an acquisition strategy that supports that level of change, whether it's new technology, methods, or new requirements.
One of the things I was going to ask is whether you know at this point whether commercial off-the-shelf solutions are going to fit your needs. But I guess if it's a service-oriented model, you don't particularly care if it's commercial or if it's proprietary, as long as the price is within the parameters that you're looking for. Is that about right?
Well, you bring up a good point. There's really three main big-picture approaches that we're looking at right now, and one of them is a commercial off-the-shelf solution. And that COTS solution could be a combination of different COTS products. Obviously, we want to focus on limited changes and customization of a COTS products because we know how expensive that is. So that is an approach that we're looking at. And then there's the approach of government off-the-shelf products. So there are several existing systems that are government-owned and operated, fully owned. That we're investigating during this phase, and then you mentioned the software as a service as an approach, and then another approach that we're looking at is called the enterprise resource planning system approach. And as you may know, the PEO program, Executive Office Enterprise Information Services, operates the Army's major enterprise resource planning systems. So how do we leverage those systems? So that's another big part of our analysis of alternatives.
Joel Phillips is the project lead for the Army Training Information System. We'll talk more about the technology models the Army's exploring as it plans ATIS after another break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin.
Exercise and breast cancer. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfus. With HHS HealthBeat, African-American women who exercise regularly seem to have a lower risk of breast cancer. Boston University researchers found this in 16 years of follow-up of more than 44,000 African-American women in the Black Women's Health Study. Lead researcher Lynn Rosenberg.
Women who exercise 7 or more hours a week had a 25% lower risk of breast cancer than sedentary women.
Exercisers did things like swimming, running, aerobics, and basketball. Women who did brisk walking also benefited, but not women who walked at a normal pace. These findings for Black women are in line with what other researchers had found earlier in white women. The study in the journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfus.
Back on federalnewsradio.com at 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Continuing our conversation now with Joel Phillips from the Army's Program Executive Office for Enterprise Information Systems. He's the project lead for a new system called ATIS, designed to replace stovepipe training systems at military bases around the country and around the world with a single enterprise solution. Before the break, Phillips told me software as a service hosted in the cloud is one model the Army's considering as its technical solution for the Army Training Information System.
So the software as a service model is one of the potential options that you're exploring, but it's not the only one, as I understand it, right? This may end up being something that's closer, if not entirely, owned and operated by the government.
You're exactly right. We're really looking at four major approaches. So I'll describe those approaches quickly. Is like you mentioned, the software as a service approach. Then there's the existing GOTS, the government off-the-shelf systems approach. We have another one that's a consumer off-the-shelf approach, where it's the best of breed consumer off-the-shelf products with the goal to be minimized customization of those products. And then the fourth approach is an enterprise resource planning approach with one of the existing ERPs that the program office already has. Now, from those four approaches, we'll develop the specific alternatives over this phase that we're in now during the analysis of alternatives, and then we'll do the analysis on those alternatives. So right now, the approach and then the alternative that we're going to ultimately choose, we're a ways from there. We're just starting that phase of the process now.
And let me combine two of the other challenges that you brought up earlier and try and get at my question about mobile identity. You mentioned both that you have concerns about security and how you actually do this through mobile platforms. Right. Security specifically on mobile devices is something I know that the entire Army and probably all of DoD is still wrestling with. Are you at a phase yet where you're confident that you can authenticate users to do this training through mobile devices in a secure way? And do you know yet exactly how you pull that off through? And you said CAC authentication is going to be your primary mechanism, but you know how that works on mobile devices?
Yeah, mobile devices, no, that's not how we're doing it. So let me give you a good example on mobile devices and where the program office is going with the use of mobile devices. As you may know, that DISA has approved different mobile devices platforms, and in fact, we have been issued those here at the program office that we use for emailing. I'm using one of them right now, matter of fact, and those devices are approved. So, and they don't require a CAC authentication unless the sender or a recipient encrypts the message. So I can open up all my messages on my mobile device right now, unless it's encrypted, and then it'll require a CAC card, which I do have an adapter, and I plug it in, and I can also encrypt or decrypt messages on my mobile devices right now.
And are you envisioning any difference in terms of the types of training that a user will be able to access from, you know, a physical desktop PC versus on a mobile device? Or are you trying to make the process as seamless as possible from mobile platform to desktop platform to whatever?
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's one of the items that we brought up during Industry Day, is what does industry think the capability of doing training on a mobile device really is? Because obviously, you know, there's the ultimate goal of, we want everything that we can do on your desktop to be delivered and able to access through your mobile device, to the reality, well, here's the reality, this is limited and here's why. Those are the kind of things we're asking industry for input on.
So let's dive into a few more process questions. Again, just to give folks a sense of where we are within the program, talk a little bit about what's happened in sort of the infancy of all this over the past year or so, and where you're going next.
Okay, so again, this goes back to one of the things I brought up earlier is the importance of the teamed environment that we've developed over the past year. So that's where I'll start. I joined this program about a year ago, and right away the way we approached it was, this is going to be a program office and a TRADOC teamed approach all the way through. And recognizing that we all have different roles and responsibilities, but because of the expertise on both sides, it's really proven valuable the way we've approached it. So with that in mind, our first work was really to discover and learn, for many of us the first time, this system called the Defense Business System, which for many who are familiar with JCIDS, or the Joint Capability Integration Development System process, this is much different. So DBS, the Defense Business System, was a shock to us, to say the least. The program had been on the path for many years to use the JCIDS process, and because of the way the Army is focusing on really understanding IT and business cost, this program was moved into that category. So the first challenge we had was understanding that process. And so from here, what we learned was, the first thing that we have to do as part of this process is develop and document the as-is systems. And this was great, because really it gave us a jump start on everything. It really gave us a chance to go out there, and start the initial analysis on what's available now, instead of, you know, just saying hypothetically we believe there's some number of systems out there and they're doing this and it's not coordinated and it's stovepiped. Well, we went out there and documented what's going on. So that initial as-is analysis is done, and this is all part of what the Army is in industry calls business process reengineering. So this first portion was completed, the as-is was completed, and then the next portion that we completed was actually defining and scoping the problem, which was critical. Defining the problem, scoping it, and then deciding and documenting what are the root causes of the problem. And based on those root causes, doing what the Army calls a .MLPF, which is doctrine, organization, training, material, leadership and education, personnel, facilities, and policy, doing an analysis of all those key items to find out how these systems aren't operating as we need them to be, and then take it to the next step and develop the as-is architecture. So that initial portion has been done.
Back to one of the things that you just mentioned, a key point that we haven't gotten to here is this is not just an IT project that gets to the whole business process reengineering. This is going to, I assume, in a lot of ways, require people to change the way that they're operating right now. Do you have a sense for the magnitude of that and the whole, you know, change exercise that this is going to be from a, again, not just IT perspective?
Yeah, that's a huge impact. So when we talk about business process engineering, it's exactly what it says, and it's not about material development. It's about changing the way people do business. So the first part is understanding the business process, finding why and what the causes or the shortfalls of the existing business process, and then mapping out proposed new business flow and new business models. So this has major effects on the spectrum of the analysis that we talked about, how the personnel are managed, how leadership is done, how training is done, because it's going to create new processes. And to give you a ballpark on how big this is, when we originally started with those five broad core capability areas for the program, from there, just one level of decomposition brought up 77 major mission needs area. And of these major mission areas, we're looking at several hundred additional details that'll be developed through the process. And those will come from the development of measures of effectiveness, measures of performance, specific capability requirements, and then finally technical requirements as we move into the material phase. But those will all have a huge impact on the business processes.
I guess one thing that might give somebody hope about that is the Army has some recent experience in doing this kind of change management around IT. I think of enterprise email, maybe even AKO before that. So now that the organization has been through some of that pain and changing IT at every post camp and station in the country, you feel like a little bit of that trail's maybe been blazed for you?
Yeah, without a doubt. Several of my sister and brother and program managers here at the program office have been very helpful. A few of them have just gone through what I went through in the business process reengineering. A few of them had just finished the major milestone that we completed, the material development decision milestone. So that learning curve has been started for me, and I was able to take advantage of that.
That's Joel Phillips, the program manager for the Army Training Information System, or ATIS. We'll wrap up our conversation and hear more about the way ahead for the program after one last break this hour. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Thanks for listening to federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbin. One more segment this hour on the Army Training Information System, a new program for the Army intended to build a single enterprise solution that replaces dozens of purpose-built Army training systems that generally don't communicate with each other. We're talking with Joel Phillips. He's the project lead for ATIS at the Army's Program Executive Office for Enterprise Information Systems.
All right, so in our remaining time, let's talk a little bit more process and look forward. Talk about some of the major milestones that you have in the program. We're not fielding this yet for a few more years, I think is the idea, right? But what happens right between now and then?
Right, so I'll focus on the next year first off, and what remains to be done. And what the next year is going to bring us ultimately is to a milestone A decision. Now, to get there, what we're focused on right now is actually conducting the analysis of alternatives. So where we are right now is we're finishing documenting the data on the existing systems and also systems that are going to require an interface. There's several additional systems that for one reason or another is exchanging data, whether they need to provide it to us or we need to provide it to them, but there's a machine-to-machine interface that we're going to have to maintain. So we have to document all that. And then we'll go through all the steps of actually evaluating the various alternatives that are put forward. We'll do the screening process. We'll do the sensitivity analysis. We'll do our detailed cost estimating procedures. And our plan is within the next 6 months to actually have that recommendation, that recommended alternative, ready to go and start the staffing process. So 6 months from now, our goal is to have the alternative ready to start the staffing process. You're looking at about a three-month process there for staffing, both at the Army and at the OSD level. And then for us as a program office, we have some big things to do internally. Of course, we'll be leveraging our mission partners over at TRADOC as much as possible, but we've got to develop the specific acquisition strategy, the acquisition plan, our systems engineering plan, various information assurance strategies, or the new term now is risk management frameworks, and lifecycle sustainment plan. And then the big one, especially for me as a PM, is developing that incremental development strategy that's going to show the Army at Milestone A, which right now is scheduled for August of 2015, how we plan to field this system, big picture, and how the legacy systems then will be retired and sunset. And then the question will be, show me the cost savings, the cost avoidance, and the return on investment.
Just to clarify something you said a moment ago, you said you're going to have to maintain a lot of machine-to-machine interfaces. Does that mean that you're going to continue to have legacy training systems out there in the environment, or are those interfaces to things that are not necessarily related to training?
Right. So those are not related to training. Those are other systems that currently rely on one or more of the legacy systems to exchange data. And their need for that data is going to most likely remain. So the plan will be for the new system to provide that interface.
And in the very near term, I think you've got your first official request for information going out to industry. Can you give us a sense of what kinds of information you're trying to gather? Is it basically the same kind of questions you were noodling through at the industry day?
Exactly. So the RFI, the request for information, was posted on FedBizOps last week. So along with that, it went through and it actually had the slides. So it described the 11 challenge areas that we're looking at. It also went into some details on the five capabilities and some details on the specifics for each one of those capabilities, so people can get an understanding of what ATIS is envisioned to be while they develop a response for these 11 challenge areas that are going to really aid us in developing ultimately the first request for proposal.
One last thing we haven't gotten to, a lot of what you're trying to build seems like it would solve challenges that I've got to imagine the other services have too. Does this have joint applicability at some point?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Without a doubt, everything has to go through that look. And initially we did that. As we staffed this through OSD and the Investment Review Board at OSD, and then that initial look has happened. And we can bet that as we refine it, it'll continue to get looked at by the other services.
Joel Phillips is the project lead for the Army Training Information System. He talked with me at the headquarters of the Army Program Executive Office for Enterprise Information Systems at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. And as he mentioned, the program has just released its first major request for information as it works through the early planning stages of ATIS. We'll post a link to that RFI along with this entire interview at federalnewsradio.com. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the program. Thanks, as always, for listening to On DoD. Hope you'll be back with us next week. I'm Jared Serbin. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
The FBI needs your help finding a Florida mother suspected of kidnapping her toddler. I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau, and this is Wanted by the FBI. Megan Elizabeth Everett of Sunrise did not return her daughter, Lily Abigail Bauman, to the girl's father, violating a court-ordered custody agreement. Special Agent Sarah Gilelli says Megan moved out of her house and never returned.
She left a note saying she was taking the daughter and she wasn't coming back, that she would rather not have joint custody. She wanted to keep her daughter for herself.
The FBI is working with its law enforcement partners and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children so that Lily can be parented by her mother and father.
Lily was born in March 2012, so she's about 2.5 now. Beautiful little girl, brown hair, brown eyes. She's a very happy, smiley kid. We just more than anything would like to reunite Lily with her dad.
Megan has ties to Canada and may be traveling in a 1999 four-door Silver Saturn. If you have information about this case, call your local FBI office.